It's that time of the year for chills, thrills, and kills with Script to Screen. Kenyatta, Mark, and I are here to be a part of your Halloween season by reviewing a few recent horror films. First up is the inventive indie sensation, Barbarian. Did this one live up to the great word of mouth, or did it fall into too many traps? We'll be continuing covering recent horror entries with Ty West's prequel to X, Pearl, and we'll have a special treat for you as we pit iconic horror movie villains tournament style to crown a champion of the horror season. Keep queuing us up all week. Remember, you can join the Boston Screenwriters Group on meetup.com and RSVP for Screenwriters Virtual Forum, peer-reviewing scripts, screen feedback, and fellow writers work while networking with them as well. Please check out the links on our anchor.fm profile to follow us online, donate, or leave us a nice message to let us know how we're doing. We hope to see you at one of these virtual forums. Until then, enjoy the podcast. All right, as always, I'd like to give an enthusiastic, warm welcome to screenwriters, aspiring writers, film lovers, and everyone in between. Your latest episode of Script to Screen, the Boston Screenwriters Group podcast, hosted by myself, J.C. Stewart, Kenyatta Hoskins, and Mark Liddell, where we come in and give screenwriter, filmmaker, and film lovers perspectives on movies, shows, and various other forms of media. Whenever you're giving us a listen, morning, noon, or night, we hope to be a great part of your listening cues and engage with you on these in-depth discussion on film, TV streaming, or whatever the hell else we like to share our thoughts on. So I'll start with the intros. I've been a co-organizer of the Boston Screenwriters Group for over 7 years, helping out the founder, Deborah Sharif, with the meetups, where we help any level of experienced screenwriter peer review the screenplays with other members. I'm also a local filmmaker on the lower end of budgets, but I'm always game for coming up with movie ideas and ready to film. Now, with all that settled, I'll pass it off to my good friend and co-organizer, Kenyatta.
Good morning. I know it was a little bit colder than it was yesterday, but, you know, it's October, so we're going to go up and down. So anyways, I've been a co-organizer for over 3 years now, and just happy to be here to talk about film, a part of the Boston Filmmakers Group for over 5 years. Been a co-organizer for over 3 years, and just happy to be here to talk about films.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Liddell. Again, like Kenyatta, happy to be here. I've been with these two guys doing this these podcasts for a little more than 2 years, 2.5 years, close to that. Now, really enjoy it. This is my favorite time of year because it's October. I'm a horror fiend, and there's always tons of stuff coming out in the movies and also on TV. They're the older stuff, and always find something new in terms of horror around this time of year. So it really gets me excited. And today we have two horror movies to talk about, or at least for the edit, we're going to talk about Barbarian and then maybe Pearl.
Yeah, so it's the beginning of October. It is the season of fright and scares and all kinds of stuff that goes bump in the night. And we figured that a couple of interesting picks were released in the last few months that we felt would be great to get our thoughts on. That is Barbarian and Pearl, very different movies in some way, but perhaps we'll find some comparison between the two. But anyway, since it's the freshest in all our memories, we decided maybe we'll start off with Barbarian. This is a Detroit set, sort of nice little inventive little horror flick from a first time director really surprised me, at least. But do we want to get our initial thoughts on it, sort of non-spoilery, or maybe we could, you know, this was short, maybe we'll just dive right into it, because I think the only real way to talk about it is to go into the spoiler territory.
I have a question though. When I watched this film, I had no idea what I was in for. I didn't watch the previews. What made me want to watch it is that just kind of like the buzz, people were saying it was very good. So I was like, okay, that's enough for me, you know. So, but you did mention this is first time director. Do you know anything about this person at all? Or so you might know, I'm just interested to know if you know anything, any backstory, like about the director or anything.
Yeah, it's a first time director. Zach Kreger, he comes from background in comedy, in fact, The Whitest Kids You Know. It's a sketch comedy show in the vein of like SNL or Mad TV, that sort of thing. I never watched it personally, but this is first time sort of helming a feature. And there's I don't know a lot about. I don't know a lot about his background other than that. But it's interesting that I didn't know a lot also about the main lead, as it turns out. The actor who plays Tess was Georgina Campbell. There we go. Yep. Thank you, Mark. And yeah, but I did know some other of the principal cast. Just like you, I kind of came into this. I saw some. I didn't really, as a lot of people know, I don't like watching trailers to movies. I didn't really get a trailer for this one, but I did see the poster, kind of just that old retro sort of. Sort of style, and maybe I thought maybe they might have something, but then yeah, word of mouth starts spreading a little bit, and I decided, oh well, might as well make this a theater trip, and I was pleasantly surprised sort of by what was put on screen. It keeps on shifting. There's different sort of it definitely goes directions that you weren't probably prepared for in the beginning. Very different from sort of how the onset. But there's of course a few things that perhaps didn't quite gel with me. But overall, I was very impressed, especially great first time outing for a director to tackle sort of something like this.
And I noticed like this big trend now on the past couple years or so that people that you're used to being in the genre of comedy, they're kind of switching over to horror, like Jordan Peele. Then you have the whole reboot of Halloween. I can't think of the name right now, but he was very heavy at the comedy.
Danny McBride.
And Gordon Green, I think, something like that. Something
David
Green.
David Gordon Green, right.
Gordon Green. Yeah. So I think it's very interesting how you have these really goofy comedies and then they switch over to completely different genre,
Yeah, he faded out. Just kind of piggyback off of that. I think it has to do with the comic timing and the horror timing. They're very similar in terms of how you execute it, how you set up a joke, how you set up a scary scene, how you build it up, and then you have the kind of punchline or the scary moment in these movies. So there's some similarity in terms of the styling, although we don't often think about horror and comedy being so closely related. But yeah, people have heard Infinitum or Ad Nauseam, I should say. For me, I don't like looking at trailers either, but I did happen to catch, the first few seconds of the Barbarian trailer while watching another movie in a theater. And it was just a setup that they show in the movie where the Georgina Campbell character is approaching this home that's kind of eerily lit. Everything else is dark around it. And from the very, that few seconds I saw her, pulling her suitcase up to the door and the look on her face, she's obviously in a place she doesn't recognize, doesn't know. And she's just, you're kind of immediately put in her shoes as being, oh no, I'm a person who can be vulnerable in a dark city. You're gonna assume you don't know anybody in this area. And there is Pennywise entering the door, right? He's not in his costume, but everyone knows, the character that, Skarsgård, Bill Skarsgård is most known for is Pennywise. So you're like, oh boy, here we go. He's creepy. I'm immediately worried about what's going to happen to her with Bill Skarsgård being a stranger in a house. And that's a wonderful setup. That's all I needed to get me into the theater for this movie. And, talking about comedy, there are comedic moments in this movie. And really, it was, the Justin Long character, AJ, that really sells a lot of the comedy in this. He was a very welcome kind of change of pace when they introduce that character into the story, because there's been so much tension in the story between the Georgina Campbell character Tess and the Bill Skarsgård's Keith characters, that he brings some kind of levity to this, well, for a while. So yeah, I really enjoyed this film. I will say, and I'll mention the things I didn't like, because there's something that really does not work for me, but I kind of cast that aside and overall really enjoyed the flick.
Well, in terms of the Justin Long character, when you talk about, you know, the comedic part of the film, I'm telling you, the part when here you are, all this creepy stuff has been happening, and then you have this change of pace where I almost felt like the movie was over. So I was like, yeah, I was like, wait a minute, what's going on? Then it just totally, you know, this character gets introduced. so anyways, the part where, you know, he discovers the secret passageways and everything. Now, this guy, he is so money hungry that none of this even affects him. It's like, you know, any other, I think, rational human being, when they see some creepy shit like that, they were like, wait a minute, what's going on? You would respond, you know, like it would normally, like any normal human being would respond. But instead, he's so money hungry, it's like it just doesn't even phase him, because he's so busy trying to get more square footage and how much money. You say, okay, you know, he's doing all this thing with the ruler and everything. I thought was hilarious that this guy was just, he became so oblivious to what any normal human being would respond to after seeing something like that. So that was like one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, and it's almost like, you know, the director's toying with you, because you feel the need to kind of like laugh at this goofy kind of character, but you know any second now something can happen, right? So you're on the edge of the verge of laughing, but not wanting to allow yourself to really fully be in the comedic part, because you know that the horror is right around the corner. At any moment when he's measuring the square footage, something can pop out, as it happened in the previous setup with the other two characters. All of a sudden this creature pops out, right? So you're just waiting for it to happen. And the way they shot the previous interaction with the beings, and how one popped out, then you have him in the same location. You're laughing, but you know that laugh can turn to fear or a scare or a scream if you're inclined to do that when something pops out. So that was perfect. You know, that scene where Skarsgård and Georgina Campbell are there and something pops out is what's in the minds of the people watching, of course, Justin Long's AJ character the whole time he's, you know, walking throughout the house.
Right. Yeah, we've sort of mentioned sort of the story beats that happen, but so to sort of get in, we start off very typical horror movies. It's a dark and stormy night, you know, the most typical sort of horror beginning you could possibly have. And it's a young woman who's staying over for a job interview, as it turns out, for a documentary. But she uses Airbnb, which is close to my heart, because I'm an Airbnb user myself. And yeah, this would be a nightmare situation for myself, not speaking of a single young woman traveling by on her own. But she meets Pennywise, Bill Skarsgård, and you're just thinking right off the bat, well, this is just not going to go, it's just going to go south very quickly. But he tries to be affable, charming, you know, giving the situation. But you just know that, something's not quite right with the whole situation. Maybe not with, maybe not with Skarsgård, but just the whole situation is just doesn't. You know, why would the booking agency, you know, overbook and just pretty much strand two people together like this? But as time goes on, there's more strange happenings in the house. Is you know, things that go, as I mentioned, things that go bump in the night. There's weird things that happen with Skarsgård's character, and it keeps on amping up. The movie is really good at very revealing sort of like the mystery. By the end of the sort of this first part, we get a complete change in what you were expecting. You know, you're expecting just, you know, I want to say, what is Bill Skarsgård character? Keith. You're expecting just Keith to, you know, just to, you know, turn off the charm and just, you know, just turn into sort of this, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer sort of character, but that there's a reversal of expectations that you know, he gets offed like by with the real menace of the movie, and we shift over to sort of the Justin Long, which is such a great sort of just change of pace that I think like it was Kenyatta that said, I thought the movie was over, and essentially the first half is completely over, and we're switching gears to a much more sort of a comedic sort of a second act, if you will, with Justin Long's actor character who gets Me Too'd, as we find out, probably appropriately so, and he needs to pay for legal fees, and he has all these developments in Detroit, which turns out to be the Airbnb, and that Tess and Keith were staying at, and so he goes to stay over at the Airbnb, and then the only thing he's thinking about is just that there's luggage lying around from previous tenants or previous visitors. He's thinking just how can I get more square footage from this place to make it more marketable on the real estate market. Just the first two, but there's a third part that happens that maybe we'll get into that really brings things around. But you wouldn't think these very huge tonal shifts would work, but Zach Cregger, as Mark was saying, horror and comedy sort of have a little bit in common, but I think it also helps that both filmmakers like Jordan Peele and also, I guess, in this case, Zach Cregger, they're horror fans, so they know the tropes of horror, and they're able to play around with it and a little bit, and play around with your expectations, and then pull the rug out from you, and switch gears like in a very inventive ways.
Yeah, that is important. You mentioned that because, again, you're placing yourself in the body and mind of this young woman who's the protagonist to start the movie out. And you've seen many a horror movie where there's a lead female actress who you expect to be the final girl at the end of the movie, and she goes through a series of challenges and revelations about what's going on. So you set up with her being there, and you're trying to think, now I'm a man, but I know what women are often told, like, don't accept strange drinks from strange people, and that's offered twice to her, and it's like, oh no, don't do this, and don't put yourself in vulnerable positions. She takes a shower at one point or whatever. It's like, no, what are you doing? So it's like he's toying with you because he knows exactly the rules for a young woman in a strange environment and what she shouldn't do, and she does all of them. She's basically is enticed to do some of them. Come stay with me, whatever. It's a rainy night, it's dark, can't find any place to stay, all these things. So you're just waiting for the titular barbarian to be revealed. I think for someone like myself who's seen a few seconds of the trailer, I thought the barbarian was going to be Keith, or the Skarsgård character, which it may or may not be if you've not seen the movie. But they really toy with your expectations, as you mentioned, and that is to wonderful effect. And of course, that's also the purpose of comedy in many ways, to subvert your expectations and give you a line, a punchline that you didn't think was going to come. Right. So and I guess also in terms of Justin Long's AJ, dude, I don't care how much square feet you have. You're not getting anything for that house. I'm from Detroit. And trust me, there are homes that were on sale in Detroit of that size for a dollar. I mean, you can buy a drink at McDonald's for, you know, more money than some homes in Detroit, at least back in the day that was the case, maybe 15 years ago. It's changing now, but still, you won't get enough to pay for your legal fees. So that was funny to see him measuring. It's like, dude, I don't care how big it is. You can have the Taj Mahal there, and you probably wouldn't pay for your legal fees because of the way Detroit's set up. Anyway. But the subversion of expectations is what was key here in the setup of this movie. The first pairing, if you will. And I'm just looking forward to what this director does next, because if this is any indication, I'm much like Jordan Peele, I'm in. Just say you're gonna make a movie, Kreger, and I'm there to watch it, because I was really satisfied with the setup and execution of the majority of this.
Yeah, it's interesting that we keep bringing that up about, because you said the majority. So it's kind of like, I two thirds of this film is masterful to me. But I do want to say too, that it's interesting the point that we all are calling Q's character Pennywise, you know, because like, we did not see it together. We probably didn't see it in the same theater, not on the same day, different time, whatever, right? So, but we all have the same response when we saw Keith's character. First thought that came across is Pennywise. So this, I wonder how much in terms of, hiring actors to play the characters, that they knew what they were doing when they hired Skarsgård to play Keith, that they knew that people were going to think Pennywise, and therefore, and then he's this guy, he's charming and everything, he's being ultra nice, but the back of everybody's head is Pennywise and the character he played in those two movies that came out recently. And so I was, now I'm watching, I was like, I wonder how much how purposeful that was. And like I said, two thirds, we could talk about the last third of the film, you know, that last third, because I think that's where a lot of, probably, I'm guessing that we have issues. I don't think there was too many issues for the first two thirds, because like I said, it's like this here. I think this was actually these last few, like couple months, have produced some very good horror films. And I would put that in that category. I think that last third of the film, it could have been fixed. Anyways, we could talk a little bit about that soon. But I love the pacing. I love the change of tone, and it was done in a very creative, masterful way. And because especially if you didn't see the previews, so I don't know. I have no idea how much the previews reveal, right? But I do want to say too that when I first heard about Barbarians, I thought it was one of those things that came on like a Peacock. You know how like sometimes it come on a streaming service, it'll come on the movie theaters at the same time. So when I saw Barbarians and I saw it on, I think it was Shudder, I thought it was the same film, and I was pissed that I subscribed to that streaming service thinking it was the same film. It was same title. It's only a year apart too, because this one is like just a year older. So I don't know how many other people made, because the same exact title and everything, but two completely different films. So I don't know how many people made that mistake like I did. But anyways, So I'm really curious to wonder if the casting was done on purpose that way.
Yeah, I would think so. I think this first time director thought, I'm going to sell a bunch of tickets just to having folks seeing Bill Skarsgård or Pennywise open the door. Like, it sold me on buying a ticket. It's like, yeah, okay, I want to see what happens when, you know, the person we know in this horror character of Pennywise is opening the door for this unsuspecting woman. And it's called Barbarian, right? So it's like, okay, he's the barbarian in my mind. But and it's different if it's Bill Skarsgård versus having like Carrot Top open the door, or is it? I don't know. It could be. It's just as horrific as Carrot Top opens, but that comedic background, he could have done something like that. But I think casting might have been everything. It might have been what got him, you know, the funding for the film, saying we have, you know, this guy who's played this horror character in, you know, seriously successful franchise over the last, you know, few years. If we have him, he sells it. Because I didn't know Georgina Campbell at all. I don't know her from anything. She's like the lead, or at least it wasn't the first part of the movie. And I think the lion's share of the cash went to Skarsgård, and what's left over went to Justin Long. Everybody else worked for scale or whatever. I don't know, because other folk really aren't well known in the movie. And for somebody who's a first time director who needs to have money for the effects and whatnot, I'm sure he was banking this whole thing on Skarsgård saying yes to the project.
Yeah. Poor Bill Skarsgård. I'm sure the guy is charming and affable, you know, in real life, but unfortunately, yeah, he's just going to be pegged as Pennywise, at least until a role comes along that allows him to really, you know, I don't know, they could cast him as James Bond. I don't know, just to try and switch things up in his career. It's definitely, that was definitely a calculation on the part of either of some of the filmmakers. Oh, you know, that will be a very easy selling point, you know. A young woman trapped in a rainy storm at night and Bill Skarsgård opens the door. I mean, that alone, you know, I'm kind of looking at the trailer actually right now. It's a very easy image to sort of sell a movie and, you know, sell tickets, get some butts in the seats, as it were. But before we sort of delve really more into, we've already kind of spoiled much of the fun here, but hopefully you've already seen the movie. Before getting into the third act, I'll get into sort of other things. There's very little use of music, or at least I didn't notice too much of a score, like even in the, especially in the first half, you know, until everything goes to hell, literally and figuratively. But there's very little score. So like, even when, you know, we have that situation with Bill Skarsgård. Keith and Tess. Even though this is a fairly awkward or intense situation, there's no real music that cues you into, you know, oh, you should be feeling this way, oh, you should be feeling that way. At least I don't. If there was a score, it was very subtle. I'm glad that they just allowed sort of performance and the images to sort of just be the storytelling, rather than just be boom stingers, bam stingers, you know, the cymbals crashing, you know, just to give you jolt you out of your seat, you know. So I was very appreciative of that. And all throughout, there isn't much of, if there was a score, it's very subtle and very sparsely used. So really they're allowing the meat of the movie to sort of stand on its own. And there's several horror scores I like, but by and large nowadays it's have that horror stinger to really, you know, bring home the scares and the jump scares. But here it's really allowing you to be more, for myself, more immersed in the story, that you're allowing it to play out and scare you on its own terms.
In some ways, you know, the jump scares or the scares are more effective. Like the last time we see the Tess and Keith characters, more effective because you don't have that music cue you in. Like, you are immersed in it. You don't know when it's going to happen. Sometimes, you know, the kind of crescendo or the loud noise that is the jump scare, or sometimes that's the scare itself, just the noise is the scare. But in this movie, it doesn't do that. It relies on, you know, a proper setup and follow through, the execution of it. And in many ways, it's kind of refreshing. I mean, this is really, not to talk about another film, I will, not in depth though. This is the anti-Smile, right? Smile, it's like all audio. And this is like, no, we're going to rely on audio to give you the scare. So I found it really refreshing that they will rely on the story and the setup as opposed to anything else.
And also, just like Smile, I mean, you brought it up because I compared it to Smile for a different reason, which is that last act. And it's like the first two thirds of both films were very masterful and everything, but that third act, things kind of fall apart. Like maybe, you know, this seemed like too much CGI and all this kind of other stuff. And it kind of feels like it falls back into the average scary movie, that's just that you could go straight, you know, you could go to the video store and like find it in the bin with no name, how like you have just a bin full of movies and you just pick out any old movie and like, oh, I never seen this before, and and you pop in and it's like that's like the everyday kind of like horror film that you always see. To me, I think both films kind of suffer. It's kind of because the first two thirds is just so refreshing, so different. It's just like the everything is just so massive. It just kind of fell apart the last. Kind of like that last third. I think both films, that's the one my comparison with Smile in this film falls into place.
Well, for me, I agree with that, as well as, you know, the ending just killed me, right? I mean, it's like, I understand this is a film, it's not real life, but it's completely far-fetched to believe what happens at the end of this movie. Maybe not so much with, I guess, the entity or being, but with the human being who's involved at the end of the movie, who kind of literally kind of walks away at the end. It's like, what? It's like, how does it's a superhuman? Like, how is this happening? You know, right. I think that took me, and it's at the end of the movie, of course, but it's like, it took me out of it. It's like, what? It's at the end, but it's like, I wanted to believe, you had me, and then it's like,
I almost felt like it was rushed to end. So yes. It's like, okay, we put all this energy, effort in the two thirds of the film. It's like, okay, we not sure how to end this, but I mean, since we're talking about the end, I mean, if we could talk about it right now, one of the disappointments is that it almost gave you a promise of something. And like, for example, there's something worse than the, I don't know what you would call this character. Was it the daughter or whatever? I don't know what name you would call, I guess the actual barbarian. I think the guy was the barbarian, I don't know. But anyways, they kind of like intimated that, okay, there's something worse down there than that. And then it's like, when the movie ended, it's like, okay, where was the whatever was worse, and it's like, I almost promised you something and they didn't give you what was promised, or they mention it. And I had so many questions, like, for example, you have all these abandoned houses surrounded this really nice house. So I'm thinking in my head, it's like all those tunnels are leading to all the other houses. And there was something they mentioned where that I like the line when he says, a copy of a copy for copy, this is what you get. And my thing is this, it's like, this is, that creature was what, 40, you know, at least 40 years old or so, okay? And they've been, kind of like, it kind of reminds me of the Hills Have Eyes remake, how you have this whole family of cannibals and they were deformed and everything because of all the toxic waste and everything. That's what that reminded me of, right? So I'm like, but was only one of them? I guess I said, is the movie called Barbarian or Barbarian? It's like plural, because if it's plural, it's like, but there was only one creature. So I'm expecting like maybe in different how, you know, there were different, where's the family?
Well, you know it's, I mean? Singular. It is Barbarian singular. Is that?
Oh, is it? Is it? Okay. Yeah. All right. So I thought, it was, okay, but why isn't it plural? Because, I mean, it's, it seems like that they were doing this for over 40 years. So why is it, where's the other baby? You know, I know she wanted a baby, but it seems like there should have been multiple ones. You know, they had all this space. Who dug all this? Anyways, it's just... I don't know. Maybe I was overthinking it, but you know, you can't help because you're trying to put, you know, everything, you know, made sense up to that point, and then things kind of fell apart. Because then you start asking logical questions, you know. But yeah, you gotta tell me what you guys thought.
Well, there's a character in the movie. Who seems like a vagrant kind of character or whatever, who lives, I guess he lives he's a squatter in some kind of a abandoned building or whatever the case might be. I think it's a water treatment center or plant or whatever. And it's like, he seems to understand what's going on. He's an older character. And what you're talking about is like, yeah, there's this horror happening for decades. And this person seems to be like up on, you know, what's going on there. He tries to warn Tess about being in that home. And you would think over 40 years, like somebody would like tip off authorities. I know you can't really rely on authorities at all time to come and take care of something, but 40 years of it, it's like somebody would come over there and either burn the place down or have the police or somebody come and address it. And I know being from Detroit, I have family who still live there, and you could have someone who's actually robbed your house and the police won't come to check it out because they say, oh, the person's gone. Okay, cool. You're good. It's like, what? So I understand sometimes neglect by police, but not 40 years of neglect and not with people, I'm sure, missing or being killed in a situation over that time span. So it's like that part is not believable, as is the case, as I mentioned before, with the ending of what happens with one, I guess, the character who walks away. It's like, nah. So, and to your point about, I guess, the other evil, the greater evil that's within the house that they kind of suggest is there, you know, part of me, when I see these kind of movies, and especially with horror, because I think in many cases they shoot multiple endings for horror movies, not knowing what's going to play well with audiences. I don't know if they've got a couple alternate endings for this where there is something greater down there, something that is much more intimidating, because the old man is just an old man. It's just like, he's nothing scary about him, but other than the fact he has a gun near him. That's the only thing scary about the old man. Yeah, I just wonder if the script was changed and they left that piece in about the greater, you know, horror or something more intimidating in the house. Because I too was wondering, okay, what's there? What's going to pop out? What's next? And there was nothing really to be afraid of other than the main baddie or main scary character in the movie, the daughter, whatever she was. Yeah.
So yeah, we're pretty deep into it, but yeah, I guess we'll get into sort of so after. Justin Long's character, AJ, that's right. That's what I was trying to, AJ is, you know, feeling about the house. He finds these passages, you know, that the same ones that, you know, Tess and Keith met their fate in. And he also encounters the being that we see sort of end the first act. And as he's being, you know, attacked and, you know, thrown into a cage with Georgina, we flashback 40 years to 1980 and what this house looked like. It looked like just your normal everyday suburban cottage right in the middle of suburban Detroit. But we focus in on focusing on Frank, and Frank just seems like a sort of a normal dude, and he's going about his errands, but there's you slowly get the idea there's something up with this guy, that he's kind of well, given that, well, also we know that you know, this house has, you know, the tunnel passages and you know, corridors and secret rooms, so we're probably thinking, is this guy the reason that for all that? And then as it turns out, yes, he is the reason for all that, because he turns out to be a stalker, serial killer, rapist, and that's been you know, haunting this area, you know, for, you know, maybe even longer than 40 years. But he sort of picks out the women that he wants to target. Very, very nice little creepy little sequence that where we see sort of the way that he operates, is that he poses as a public works public works officer, or someone from the DP Department of Public Works, and he just says, can we look at the sink, or can we look at the water flow in your bathroom, because we're doing you know, water break testing. And then he just goes in and just unlocks the window for later. It's just a nice little very, and I think also based on sort of true crime sort of a true crime profiles as well. We just see that that this is sort of the beginning of all the happenings that happen in this house. As for the title, the house is on Barbary Street, so you can there's a little bit of an allusion there. But yeah, I think that the title refers to Frank. Refers to this complete psychopath of a person, just sort of and his in his crimes just infesting this area over time, and just leading to just rot and decay. And we sort of get allusions to, you know, the stuff links of his crime. You know, we see the videotapes, and we don't need to see what's on the videotapes, because the descriptions are good enough. We don't need to see the horrible stuff, but, and also AJ's reaction to it is also enough, which is a nice little sort of pulling back. We don't need to, you know, we just need a good idea of what the extent of what was going on. But then the vagrant character sort of explains that they kept on having kids through the, you know, his assaulting women over the years, and they had kids, they had on top of kids. And like Kenyatta said, this is a Hills Have Eyes situation, where inbred just leads to complete feralness of the offspring. And you know, we don't know the one that attacks, the one that we see, maybe not be 40 years old, maybe might be just a little younger. But all that inbred and being, you know, raised feral basically, or not raised at all, just led to just this also another type of sort of a barbarian. I didn't have as much of a problem with the ending as both of you, apparently. I think it leads, you know, at I was glad that Georgina was still around. She's portrayed as sort of overly trusting. She talks about, you know, the relationship that she stayed in way too long, because she was just too trusting of her partner. I think that that carries on throughout the rest of that. It sort of informs the rest of her decisions, you know. Yeah, really, really not great decision work on her part, but I think it is set up at least that she's overly trusting. She tries to, you know, she tries to make best of the situation in the beginning, and that leads to sort of the really bad stuff that she's going through at the moment. I'm glad that AJ also sort of gets his comeuppance. It's also another sort of subversion of expectation. You think that AJ is going to go through an arc. You know, he starts out as this sort of heel of a character. He's called out for for assaulting a cast member, and he's essentially like trying to drum up legal fees for the coming sort of trials. And you think, well, this guy will have an arc, but no, it turns out that he's just a coward and a complete sort of self-serving tool that he doesn't, you know, do the noble thing and, you know, try to fend off the creature from Georgina. He essentially uses her as bait to throw her off the water tower. And that's fine. That's, you know, that's an subversion of expectation, sort of, because you don't need every character to go through an arc. Like some people are just as it turns out he's not the main character either. It's Georgina sort of realizing, you know, what has been going on in, you know, on Barbary Street and in this quaint little house, and realizing sort of the different layers of of evil that has gone on. So yeah, I didn't have as much of a problem. Yeah, there's something. Yeah, you know, surviving a fall, you know, I don't know, 40 or 50 foot fall tall, but just landing on mother character, maybe is a little bit overdoing it. But, you know, at that point, you kind of just want, you know, someone other than AJ to walk away from this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that I think the whole story with the guy, and I think that was a very good scene. And that's what made the last third of the film so disappointing, that it didn't match with the other two parts of the film, in a sense that this person, like I said, I want to give it a name, but I guess you said mother, I don't know. But the daughter, I guess, it seems like they were bulletproof and they were indestructible. It's kind of like a Marvel villain or something, instead of, you know, to me, it didn't, I don't know, it just kind of fell apart, especially what made it fall apart so far is because, like I said, they did so well with the first two parts. There's a lot of things that kind of like questions, it left a lot of questions. It's like they didn't know how to end this film. But I do agree, and I think a lot of actors, I really think everybody did. Justin Long, I know a lot of people say he's like one of the worst actors. I think personally, I think he did a good job in this film. And also, you know, what's her name? Regina Campbell, is that her name?
Georgina Campbell, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I think she did a good job. I think everybody did in terms of acting. And so I just, that's one of my biggest problems with the last part of the film. It's just, it became kind of like Jason Voorhees or Mike Myers territory, you know what I mean? Because up until then, things felt kind of like more realistic, because he even said kind of like Netflix has these documentaries on these serial killers, and the way they told it, it was like, it felt realistic in terms of a documentary is done on the actual person. And then it kind of, the tone just totally switched. If it was done differently, I think it would have capped this film off perfectly. But it was just, it felt like they didn't know what to do with the end.
Yeah, I would second that. And if you're talking about someone being indestructible or Marvel villain or whatever, that person would be Tess. Because, I mean, she was thrown off of a water tower. It's like 40 feet in the air, hit and she dusts herself off and walks away. It's like, what? It's like, again, I just think that that's one of these kind of tacked on endings. I don't even know if they had a different ending with this other kind of third act piece where they do have something more terrifying in the basement and she's got to contend with that. And they realized through test audiences, maybe that didn't work out. So they just threw her off the water tower and she dusts herself off and into the movie. It's like, okay. That for me, it's like you've done everything so well up until this point, and then to have that end the movie for me just left a bad taste in my mouth. So you had it. You had a masterful, you know, piece and until that whole sequence, right? And it's almost like the Vagrant character kind of mentioned that the entity, the being, had a certain set of rules. That it would never come into this territory where he lived or whatever. And he's been there for a long time. He's an old man, and this is like a 40-year span. I'm guessing he's been there for most of it. And somehow, some way, she breaks from whatever her rules are and ends up there just on this one occasion. I found it to be just odd that happened to be the case. But, of course, it's for the sake of the movie that we have to, you know, have this happen. But, yeah, I just think there could have been a different way of ending it rather than having Tess walk away from a 40-foot fall with like no broken bones or anything else.
Right, yeah, and a gunshot wound also. Like, it's like, so she's been shot, thrown off a water tower, and she's able to still walk, under her own power, which is, yeah, as you said, pretty much like a Marvel movie, superior to that power. But I do agree that as soon as they leave the house, you lose that claustrophobic horror that they've been doing so well up to that point. You also figure that the main reason why this the mother character is, you know, has that advantage over everyone who wanders in is because they grew up in this. They don't have their eyesight is trained to darkness, and they can move more quick. But once you get outside and the streetlights and the moonlight, you think you would that equalizes out, and the terror is a little bit less so. So yeah, I do agree. They probably should have figured out a way to end the movie in the tunnels, because everything in there is just horrifying. Like, you know, even if there isn't a mother walking around, or it's just that everything is lit just by that your phone flashlight, and it's you're barely seeing anything, and what can come out of the darkness, what's around every corner. It's very much we'll do movie recommendations, but it's very much like one of my favorite horror movies of the last 20 years. It's with that claustrophobic horror that they were doing so well. And yeah, once they get up above that, once they leave the house, it loses it quite a bit. So I totally agree there that they should have found a way to end it either in the tunnels or in the house. And once you leave the house, the power and the power that of that is sort of drained.
And to your point, it's like not only are the being's eyes adjusted to the location, it's almost like walking around your house. You can walk around with your eyes closed. You don't even need to see, right? So it's the familiarity with the environment, what's in it, what's not in it, and where you can go, what's a dead end, what's not, is what makes it, as you said, scary and claustrophobic, because you're in this environment. You don't know what's around the corner. And that thing has an advantage over you in that spot, right? As opposed to being out in the open. And I guess what frustrates me also is, even though the vagrant tells them that the being never comes that far, it's like, if I've seen what I've seen, I'm not stopping moving. I'm going to keep moving as much as I can, as far as I can. I know you have a gunshot, but if you could, walk after being thrown off the tower, you can walk, to get away from this being, right? I'm not going to sit on my laurels and wait for the thing to catch up to me by waiting across the street or down the street, basically. So, it's almost like, the trope of someone running from the evil character in a movie and tripping and falling and getting up and tripping and falling again. It's like that's what this character did. Tripped and fell a couple times, one by not being in perpetual motion, just stopping at this location down the street. And two, I guess not realizing that it wasn't wise to return to the home before anyway. She returned at one point after knowing what was wrong with it and had the conversation with Skarsgård's Keith character. She laid the groundwork for being too trusting, as you mentioned, JC, but I would imagine too trusting in a relationship with a boyfriend or whomever, not just a casual, I guess, interaction with a person you met the day before, right? She doesn't know Keith at all. And she had her suspicions. So I wouldn't feel that committed to supporting Keith or having his back or waiting around. Like, no, I know what's in the basement. I'm not going back, number one. And number two, I'm not going to wait around for Keith to emerge from the basement. Nor will I follow him down there. It's just like, so, yeah, that just doesn't kind of ring true. But I guess I would love to see or talk to Craig or anybody else who is involved in this project to see what the alternate endings were. I guarantee there were alternate endings to this movie because this one, for me, doesn't work. Maybe the others did or would work, I should say.
Yeah, I agree. I am curious to know if there are any other kind of ending because, you know, like movies like Get Out showed us that there was another ending. And there are other films that had alternate endings. So I wonder if the Blu-ray comes out and, you know, how they have the extras, if they have an alternate ending, because I'll be interested to know what that is. It's like, why did they go with this one? If there is, first of all, number one, I'm curious if there was another ending. And number two, if there is, I'm wondering why, what their rationale for going with this one is, because yeah, it just changed everything.
I see the problems with the ending, and I do agree. I do. It's they kind of pull the punches, if you will, just right at the end, which kind of which is kind of a letdown. But I think overall, just the strength of especially the first two acts, you know, coupled together, the inventiveness of the shifting story, I think, it's too much. There's too much good for me not to, of course, recommend it, especially to horror fans. And yeah, there's some, you know, glaring problems with the ending, but sometimes sometimes the filmmakers provide such a great immersive sort of experience, at least with the beginning, that it kind of overpowers the end. And seemingly it worked for a lot of other people. I don't have as much of a problem with it, but I do think as you said, there is probably an alternate ending, at least that stays in the house or stays in the tunnels, just keep up that claustrophobic horror.
Yeah, because I know, like, there are some, you know, because we mentioned other films, and another film I could think of is Don't Breathe, how you have this house, and then it's surrounded, also in Detroit, I believe, and you have all these abandoned houses and stuff like that, and what's so masterful about Don't Breathe is that third act went along with the first two acts, and the ending was masterful. You get what I'm saying? So it was consistent throughout. And I think the director of this film and his next film, he should trust, what he did with the first two parts, and just, you know, pay attention to that third part. That's my only criticism. Something I hope he does better the next film he does. But I agree with you that the first two parts were so good that I still have to recommend it. Because I just think if it was a better third part, it would really been kind of like on that level of other films, recent films like I said, Don't Breathe, and also Green Room, you know, that sort of, you know, it would have been up there with those films. But like I said, the first two parts are so well masterful and constructed and crafted that I still have to recommend it. I may not give it an A plus, but I'll give it, you know, I'll give it a B minus or so.
You kind of stole my thunder. I was thinking about Don't Breathe as well. Of course,
same here. I was just I was going to mention that too.
yeah. Set in Detroit. However, Don't Breathe was set and shot in Detroit. This was shot somewhere in Europe. Although Detroit is, I mean, many areas is almost like set up for a dystopian nightmare situation. But this one was, I mean, shot, I think, is it Bulgaria or someplace like that? Or was it? But yeah, I agree with what you said. I second what you just mentioned, Kenyatta. And yeah, Don't Breathe came to my mind as well. That's odd. All three of us kind of were in the same mindset around that.
I'd also say, you know, not to go too much into spoilers, Don't Breathe also has the problem of leaving the house. Once they leave the house, like, yeah, just seemingly you, everything you've set up in the first, you know, first or second, you know, three acts, you know, kind of is dispelled. And you kind of, maybe Don't Breathe has a stronger ending, but yeah, it has a sort of the same problem. Once you leave the house, once you leave that great setup, you kind of have to find another way to scare, you know, another way to set up all the scares, and not as effectively, in my opinion.
But at the same time, the difference is they end up back in the house. They went outside.
Okay. They go back. Yeah. All right. Okay. It is true. That's true. Too true. All right.
It's almost like letting the air out of a balloon, right?
Yeah,
like
exactly. That's exactly.
The tension builds up, the air goes out the balloon. You might go back to the balloon, but the air, balloon doesn't have as much air in it, right? It's lost a little bit of something, you know?
Exactly the metaphor I was trying to get at. Thank you, Mark. That was exactly what I was trying to think of. Yeah, you're just letting all the scares out of that balloon. Like once you have this great setup, like whether you're in the tunnels or even just the house itself, the way they film it is, you know, there's eerie pans around, you know, a la, I don't know, Paranormal Activity, where, oh, is there going to be something in the corner? Is there going to be something, you know, right in center frame? Just the house itself, it was almost, even though it's this, you know, very, upscale sort of Airbnb, you know, rental place. You know, I've stayed in a couple Airbnbs. That's a really nice one. AJ did a good job, or at least the agency did a very good job of upkeeping, at the very least. When you rely so heavily on, you know, claustrophobic horror, you know, what's around the corner, what's right down the hall, and then you get out into the open, yeah, it just lets all the air out, and you just need to find a way to end end the story there. Like, that's where your strongest element is.
I've never used Airbnb, but I would imagine they must have like a rating system of some sort. I'm wondering what the ratings would be for this house. I mean, if no one makes it out alive, maybe they have zero ratings, or maybe they've got, you know, they intermittently have the ghouls from the basement come in and I guess eat or attack people or whatever they do to them, give birth to them, feed them, whatever. Every now and then, and just enough so they have enough ratings to so people will allow them to stay in the Airbnb. But it just, yeah, given the location, I would think that there'd be a lot of negative ratings and nobody would want to stay there, but I guess not.
Zero stars. I didn't make it out of the house. I didn't ever make it back. There was no mother didn't come to see me in the middle of the night. That would be interesting to see. My guess is that this is on the cheaper side of Airbnb stays in the area, and that's what drew Tess and Keith here. That's a little interesting little part of the story that, it, especially for someone like me, you know, when you're traveling, you don't know the areas, you don't know what the, you know, the bad areas and the good, you know, the better areas, the safer areas are in the city that you're going to stay in just for a few days. So when you're looking for, you know, an Airbnb and, you know, it's on the cheaper side, it has, you know, decent ratings and whatnot, that would probably be the first, you know, the first booking that you would make, but not knowing, you know, this is in the middle of, you know, not a great neighborhood or something. That was a very effective little sort of thing. They don't really touch upon it, but I think that's what they're trying to at least allude to. Although I will say, you know, we kind of dunked on the ending and whatnot, but I do think the end stinging song is that was good. That was good. It's Be My Baby by the Ronettes. And it's yeah, that was good. That was a very good thing. And again, you know, some, you know, survivability, you know, plausibility, you know, notwithstanding, I think that that's the filmmaker saying, you know, we had a fun time, folks, right? It's like, and we're giving you this little stinger to go out on. So, you know, don't, yeah, don't take, you know, the survivability, possibility of some characters, you know, too well, too much.
Surprised Airbnb allowed themselves to be associated with it.
That's true. That is, yeah, that's good. That's good.
That's not a ringing endorsement of Airbnb.
But it was a really well kept house, you know. That I guess that yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, you would think that they would have to come up with something else, another company name. All right, we want to move on to Pearl.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Do we want to do film? I guess we kind of did film recommendations, but do we want to do film recommendations for Barbarian before we move on?
Let me do it all at once, maybe at the end.
Okay, we do. Yeah, we could do all at once, certainly. Okay. So, yeah, that was Barbarian. Do go see it if it's still playing in theaters. It's a nice little, it's a very good, you know, two-thirds of a movie and an okay, decent, you know, ending that kind of undermines the first two halves. But, yeah, overall, a good time at the movies. And a very good, another sort of... if A24 is too, you know, high-minded and pretentious and, you know, kind of takes the air out of your horror viewings, yeah, this is, you know, this is a good alternative, in my opinion, you know, movies like this.
We hope you enjoyed listening to our thoughts on Barbarian. Despite some misgivings on the ending, we certainly want to see what Zach Cregger and company can produce next. Be sure to keep queuing us up as we continue gearing up for the horror season, covering Ty West's prequel to X, Pearl. We'll also be crowning our champion of the horror season, tournament style, pitting iconic horror movie villains head-to-head. Find out who comes on top. Feel free to leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and on the platforms. You can support this podcast and the Screenwriters Group with a monthly donation by clicking on the support button at anchor.fm. You can join Kenyatta and I, our virtual screenwriters forums, by RSVPing on meetup.com and our Facebook. Subscribe to our channel on YouTube, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Links are in the description. All the best in your writing, watching movie and streaming shows, and taking care of one another.